Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. Matthew Prescott, author of Food is the Solution, will be my guest today, and I'll tell you more about Matthew in a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the city, share some things in the news with you, and, of course, my weekly recipe. So, I had a fun day on Tuesday in New York City. I went down to Union Square and joined a rally for Grannies Respond. And if you haven't heard about Grannies Respond yet, just Google it, Grannies Respond, and you'll see what's coming up. It's been in the news a lot lately. It only started as someone's idea, I think, 5 weeks ago, and it's just taken off crazy on Facebook and such. But there are caravans of older women, and, of course, there's some men joining in as well, but heading to McLean, Texas, to the border, to protest the cruel and inhumane treatment of immigrants and people coming to this country to escape torture and violence in their countries and looking for a better life for them and their families and children. And they're met with separation at the borders and horrible situations. And so there is this caravan of women. They have a busload of women going, and then there's other cars following them, and they've created this caravan. And they're making 20 stops along the way, picking up more people as they go. This group started from Beacon, New York, although there were people that came down from Northampton, Massachusetts. There was the rally Tuesday in New York City, and then the following day in Pennsylvania. And every day they were stopping in a few different places, picking up more people along the way. And we heard that there's also a bus coming from Portland, Oregon. There's one coming from Wisconsin. There's one coming from Michigan. I mean, there's buses and people coming from all over, and they're supposed to convene on August 6th at the border, and I can't wait to see how many people actually end up showing up. But it's really gaining momentum, and it's just a nice thing. I don't know exactly what they will be doing once they get there, other than protesting the treatment, and there'll certainly be a rally and talks. But follow it on Facebook, like them, and spread the word. But it's really just wonderful to see people, motivated to put their beliefs into action. And that's something that I talk about a lot. I think all of us can use to do that more, whether it's, in the food we eat, in the way we take care of our lawns and our gardens, what we put down on the earth, how we think about decisions we make today and how they're going to affect people down the road, not just next week or next month, but years into the future. And we really need to think that way, because our government right now certainly is not. And we need to work together to create the world that we want to see. So I'm also heading to Pennsylvania this weekend myself. That's one of the reasons I couldn't go on this caravan with the grannies, to the Himalayan Institute, which is a yoga institute in the Poconos, Honesdale, Pennsylvania, and I am participating in a bereavement retreat. I was asked if I could do a cooking demo for this bereavement retreat. That is going to be a two-day immersive opportunity for people who are working through the loss of a loved one and ways that they can work through it, whether it's through some art projects, some hikes, some yoga, talking, journaling. And one of the things that they're going to do is also learn about cooking. I pulled up a rule book or a recipe from the Happiness Diet, which Drew Ramsey wrote the book, The Happiness Diet. And I've had him on my show. And, it's really just wonderful to see doctors realizing that food has a real impact and making choices of prescribing foods for people to eat to deal with depression rather than just writing another script. And there's lots of events coming up. And one of the events that I actually wanted to share with you is a healthy eating conference that's taking place in Asheville, North Carolina. And I know that's a schlep if you're in the New York area, but wherever you are, it's really for health professionals, whether you're a doctor, MD, psychiatrist, social worker. If you're working with people and helping them through health issues, whether it's mental or physical, this might be a conference you want to go to. It's called the Healthy Eating in Practice Conference, and it's a hands-on conference for physicians and other healthcare professionals, August 26th to the 29th in North Carolina. And I'll tell you more events that are going on in just a little bit, but I just want to bring that up while I'm talking about food and the impact that can have on mental health and wellness. And so I'm really excited to be participating in this. And I certainly have lost many people over the last few years. And so it will be nice to just focus on those people that I love that aren't in my life anymore and remember them. So I'm looking forward to that as well. And some things that I wrote about this week that I'd like to encourage you all to participate in is, to write some letters. There is a situation, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are building up coastal storm dams, like protection for climate change, but they're not really checking out the impact that those water barriers would have on the life in, in our case, the Hudson River estuary. And, the impact plan is not really in place for some of these things that they're planning on doing. And so they're asking people to write letters and to become more involved and find out more about this situation. So please check out a website that you can go to. What is it called? Just Google the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Hudson Storm Surge Barriers, and you will find out more information about that. But it's really, an important situation for us all to look into. And also, the New York Healthy Soil Coalition, there was a great consensus that happened this past week. There was a soil health summit that took place, actually July 18th, and there was a consensus that we really need to build up the soil for many reasons, not just for better farming practices and better food, but also just as a way to really combat climate change, building up the soil so that it can sequester some of the carbon that is in the atmosphere is a way to really deal with climate change, and it's a way to use farming to help mitigate the problems that we're dealing with. And so the New York Soil Health Summit that took place came away really feeling optimistic that everybody was on board. It wasn't just the Northeast Organic Farming Association coming from an organic standpoint, but it was also the Farm Bureau coming from a more traditional standpoint, coming together in consensus to really recognize the power that we can have in farming in a ecological way. And so that was really exciting. I want to share with all of you this week's recipe. And this week's recipe I actually took from Matthew Prescott's book, Food is the Solution, What to Eat to Save the World. And this recipe was really exciting because it's rice paper bacon. And I don't know how many of you have made my TLTs in the past. That's a tofu, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. But I make tofu in such a way that it mocks a bacon type of thing, and it's really a great recipe, and I love it. And when I saw his rice paper bacon, I just was really intrigued because it looked so much like the real thing. And for so many people, your eyes is the first thing you see. And so when you see something that resembles what you're mocking, very often people are more open to it. So this used 10 sheets of rice paper, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 3 tablespoons of tamari, or you could use, and tamari is gluten-free. You could use soy sauce, but I use tamari because that way it was gluten-free, 2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast, 1/2 teaspoon of liquid smoke, 1/2 tablespoon of maple syrup, 1/4 teaspoon of onion powder, and 1/2 teaspoon of garlic powder, and then also some black pepper and a pinch of paprika. And you preheat the oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And rice paper, there's different qualities of rice paper, I found out. I had one package that was already open, and then I had another package. And the package I had that was already open, it was much thinner than the other package, and so it didn't cut as well. So if you have a package that's really thin rice paper, you might want to, and it's not cutting well, you might want to try a different brand. But first you're going to whisk together all of the ingredients to make a marinade. And I did that in a wide bowl so that I could just dip the bacon sheets right into it. And then prepare a metal oven-safe rack with a sheet of parchment paper on it. So that was, you know, a big cookie sheet, and I put down some parchment paper. You cut the rice paper into thick strips so that they're the, you know, the thickness of like 3/4 inch, kind of the thickness that one would see a bacon slice. And the strips actually shrink a little bit when cooking, so you can go a little bit bigger than you think. And then you're going to take 2 strips together and put them together, and you're going to dip them quickly into a pan, another pan that you have next to the marinade, just with some water. And you can dip them into water, and that just softens them. And that would help them stick together. So you can take your 2 fingers to the 2 pieces of rice paper and just, once you dip them in, put your 2 fingers together and help the 2 pieces stick together. And then I dipped the rice paper strips into the marinade. And you can also use a brush if you want, but I just found it easier to dip them. And again, I used my fingers to squeegee off any of the extra marinade. And then I repeated that until all the rice paper was used up, going from the water into the marinade. And then I laid it out onto the cookie sheets that were covered with parchment paper. And I actually sprayed them lightly with a little bit of canola oil spray. And I baked them in the oven for 7 to 9 minutes. And everyone, you know, ovens are all different. My back of my oven's a little bit hotter than the front. So halfway through, I turned the cookie sheet around so that I wouldn't burn the back ones. And just keep an eye on it because it goes from being not quite done to being very well done quickly. And then you remove it and let it cool a bit before you use them. And that's it. And they will stay really well in a Ziploc bag for up to 3 days. And they're really great, and that's one of the many recipes that you'll find in Matthew's book, if you check out Matthew's book. And so let me tell you a little bit about Matthew before I invite him on to join the show. Matthew's the author of Food is the Solution, What to Eat to Save the World. He's an advisor to the Good Food Institute, Senior Director of Food and Agriculture for the Humane Society of the United States, and a leading figure in the global movement to reform how we eat and how we farm. He has spoken for many Ivy League universities, Fortune 500 companies, consumers, and more, and he's really helping to lead the changes in the supply chains of hundreds of major food companies, and he's impacted hundreds of individuals' diets, and he's been covered extensively by the media. His work's been featured by CNN, in the pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the Boston Globe, and countless more. He's also been a guest on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he currently lives in Texas, and I'm so thrilled to have him on. Matthew, are you with me?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Thank you, and thank you for that great recipe. The game changer.
Yeah, I hope you liked it.
I definitely liked it. I liked it a lot. So
awesome.
That was really, really wonderful.
On your TLPs.
Uh-huh. They will be. So let's start by first telling me just a little bit more about your history. What inspired you to first get into food?
You know, I've always loved food. I've loved eating. I've loved cooking. I felt always comfortable in the kitchen. Some of my earliest memories are, you know, as a little kid, helping my mother prepare meals and organizing our spice cabinet and just being in the kitchen and around food. So you fast forward to me as an adult, and I kind of made a career out of being a food advocate. I've worked for almost 20 years trying to make our food supply more humane and more sustainable, chiefly through advocating that we eat more plant-based foods. And so this book is really kind of a combination of my food advocacy and my experience working with food as a chef and, as a home chef and as a vegan of 20 years now. And so half the book is kind of informational, infographics and essays and photography, and then the other half is all recipes.
Mm-hmm. And so did you train as a chef? Did you go to culinary school, or are you self-taught? How did you...
Just totally taught, and so the recipes in this book are some of my favorites that I've been making for many years. The rice paper bacon is one, and seitan kebabs, and veggie sushi, and all kinds of other stuff that have been staples in my home.
Mm-hmm. And, this is really unique, combining the two books in one. You know, like you said, it's, one half is talking about food advocacy and what we can do, and the other is a cookbook. How did you get the idea of combining them into one book?
Well, I wanted to make kind of a one-stop shop for folks. A lot of people now are looking to eat more consciously. They're looking to find more environmentally friendly foods, more humane foods. And they're interested in the issues. They want to know how different foods impact the environment. And so I wanted to create, just a one-stop shop where people could get all the information they're looking for, read some interesting essays, see some beautiful photography, check out some infographics and charts, but then also have the recipes right there at their fingertips. So, they can get the why in the first part of the book and then the how in the second part of the book with the recipes.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about the whys, because, that's something that I talk about a lot on my show, and why it's, such a good idea for everybody to try to aim towards eating more plant-based. And you talk about health issues, compassion, and environmental reasons. Let's talk about those a little bit. Can you start with some of the environmental reasons?
Yeah, and that's really the focus of my book, is on the environmental implications of what we eat. A lot of people now are coming to realize that animal-based foods, meat, dairy, eggs, fish, that those foods are really taxing on the environment. One of the statistics that I came across when researching for the book is the amount of water used to create different foods. And, a lot of people don't realize that just to produce one single egg, it takes 53 gallons of water. That is a lot of water just for a single egg. And same, goes for milk and meat. The numbers are even higher. A hamburger uses about 600 gallons of water. This is because it's just really inefficient to use animals for protein. We've got to, cut down forests to grow crops, to feed the animals. We have to grow all this grain, ship it around the world, process it, feed it to the animals who are, often confined on factory farms and flocks. And basically, animals are just really inefficient at converting the food that we feed them into meat for us to eat. For, we lose about 86%, calorically speaking, of what we feed an animal in terms of what we get back out as food. And so it's just a super inefficient process, and it creates all kinds of environmental problems in the process: using too much water, using too much land. Meat, dairy, and egg are now responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change than all the cars and trucks in the world combined. And the list just kind of goes on. And so a lot of people are looking to eat more plant-based foods as a way to lighten their footprint on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great thing for them to do. I mean, it's changed so much from, when we were hunters and gatherers. When you were hunting animals for survival, the animals weren't being raised just for that. So, what they were eating was just all natural. It was out there for them. What they were drinking was just what was out there for them. It wasn't, being produced by us in order to feed them. And it always got me. I mean, I remember I first got on this path when I was 16. And I read Diet for a Small Planet. And, I was just astonished with how much land is used to grow the food, and this was so many years ago already, it's tripled probably by now, how much land was used to grow food to feed those animals, and how much land was used to graze those animals, as opposed to growing food to feed people.
Yeah, it's incredible. About a third of all the land on the entire planet is used for animal farming in some capacity, either to raise the animals themselves or to grow crops that are used to feed them. A third of all the land now goes for that. It's just a really incredible use of land. And we can be much more efficient in the way we use our natural resources, be it land or water or fossil fuels, by focusing more on producing plant-based foods. They're much less resource-intensive to make. They're lighter on the planet. And, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, they're better for us. They're a healthier product. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of a win-win for everybody, certainly for the animals who are left out of the equation, but also for us and for our planet.
Yeah. Also, you know, the food that we're feeding to the animals, you know, is primarily GMO food now. And, I had Jeffrey Smith on, a while back, but we were talking about how GMOs actually are being transmitted, like secondhand GMO contamination. So, so many people have heard about genetically modified foods and they're trying to avoid eating GMOs, but they don't realize if you eat animals that are eating GMOs, that's a whole other way of getting GMOs into your body.
Yeah, and certainly another way of implicitly helping support the GMO industry by eating animal products that have been produced from animals who have been fed GMO crops.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about all the land and all the resources used to raise animals, and then last week I had somebody on, we were talking about food waste. And, you think about 40% of all the food that we grow is actually wasted and ends up in the landfill, creating more methane in the environment. And then you think of all those resources that are also being wasted. It's not just the food that's being wasted, but, all that land, all that water, all that food that went into raising that food that's now being wasted. It's hard to wrap your brain around.
Yeah, especially when what we're wasting are animal-based foods. I mean, food waste of any kind is really bad. Whether you're wasting lentils or you're wasting, a pork chop. But when we throw out and we don't eat all of, or when we waste, we let it go bad. Animal-based foods, it's especially bad. Pork, for example, it takes about 700 gallons of water per pound of pork to produce. A pound of tofu takes less than half that. And so, a lot of people, when they think of food waste, they think about just kind of the moral implications of throwing out food in a world where so many people are going hungry. But, another major problem with that is, you're right, all the resources that have gone into producing that food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's astonishing. And let's talk a little bit about some of the health benefits of eating plant-based, or the negative impact that eating a diet so heavy on animal products has on one. What did you find out in researching for this book that you found really amazing that you want to share?
Well, if I could plug another book, one amazing book on this topic that I really highly recommend to anybody who is struggling with health or has a relative struggling with health, is a book called How Not to Die by Dr. Michael Greger. He's a physician who produced this book that very conclusively shows that all of the top killers in America, heart disease, cancer, stroke, and then also a host of other health problems, from rheumatoid arthritis to all on down the line, are directly linked to meat-heavy diets, and that the number one way that we can reverse these problems is by eating more plant-based foods. In fact, the only doctor to ever reverse heart disease, to actually cure heart disease in patients without the use of medicine, did so by prescribing a plant-based diet. And so many people now across the country and across the world are kind of becoming hip to this message. They're seeing films like Forks Over Knives, or they're reading the book that I mentioned, How Not to Die, and they're changing their diets. They're doing meatless Mondays. They're eating smaller portions of meat. They're moving meat from the center of the plate to the side of the plate, or they're, you know, becoming vegetarian or vegan entirely, because so much evidence shows that it's the best thing we can do for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I joke with people saying I'm a vegan wannabe, and, you know, I primarily that's the diet I eat, but sometimes I eat other foods when I'm out, meaning, you know, some dairy or whatever. But primarily I'm eating a vegan diet. And I've been doing that since I was 16. And I have to say that, you know, for me, it's what makes it, it's certainly what makes sense. But Dr. Greger actually goes even more than just talking about eating plant-based. He also really promotes low salt and low fat or low oil, correct?
Yeah, that's definitely right. Salt and high fat content foods are also of course linked to, you know, problems like hypertension and other ailments that we may suffer from. But Dr. Greger's book, How Not to Die, his research does include those other things, but it's very predominantly focused on eating more plant-based foods. And, you know, I think you bring up a good point about the way that you call yourself a vegan wannabe. I try to stick to a vegan diet as much as I can as well. I've done that for 20 years. A lot of people nowadays are, you know, what they call flexitarian. Some people are doing vegan before 6 p.m., which is a thing coined by the author Mark Bittman, where he talks about eating a vegan diet before 6 p.m., and then basically from dinner onward, anything goes. Tofu scramble for lunch and a TLT for tofu scramble for breakfast and a TLT for lunch and then a steak for dinner. And I think that people should do, you know, whatever diet works for them. There's so many different iterations of it. You know, I myself choose to be vegan. So many other people do, but there's no, right or wrong way to get on the path toward more sustainable eating. If doing Meatless Mondays works for you, you know, I say go ahead and do it. The more the merrier.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think it's really important for everyone who's listening to realize that it's not something that is just going to happen overnight for you. This is a process. It's something to aim towards if you're not there already, because we recognize that it's challenging, and there's so much other food out there that, you know, temptation, and then there's, you know, family gatherings, and you also want to be able to participate in a lot of things. So it's something to aim towards, but it's certainly, as you're talking about, it's so much better for the environment and our health that it's a win-win on so many, many different levels. Can you share with us some other messages in your book that really stuck out with you? I know you've got lots of famous quotes from many quotes from many famous people at the beginning of your book. It's pretty amazing. Any particular message that really stuck with you?
Well, you know, I was really fortunate to have the support of a lot of notable people for the book. James Cameron, the film director who directed Titanic and Avatar and so many other blockbusters, he wrote the foreword to the book. It features essays from people like the actor Jesse Eisenberg, who is kind enough to contribute an original essay to the book. People like the president of Greenpeace and the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council have essays in there. And I wanted to include these other messages from a wide range of people just to show readers that there are all different ways to go about eating more sustainably, and there are all different kinds of people who are doing this now and who are advocating for this. So, I think that Rhea Sue, the head of the Natural Resources Defense Council, has a really great message in the book where she talks about her childhood growing up in Colorado and her connection to food, and how by eating more plant-based foods, we can all kind of start on the path toward eating more sustainably. Of course, her group NRDC is one of the biggest environmental forces out there. And so, I really encourage people, if you see the book in a bookstore, just kind of flip through and check out some of these people's essays. They're really short. Each one's only about a page long, and a lot of interesting stuff in there from different people.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a couple minute break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the stories that you've included in the book, you know, stories about Americans whose lives were really changed and disrupted by some of the animal production that's going on in the country. So, everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be right back.
This is Heidi Boghossian, co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. Tune in Wednesdays at 5 p.m. to hear timely analysis on issues concerning civil liberties, privacy, the right to dissent, and even practices of torture by the U.S. government and private corporations. Our guests are leading authorities in their fields from around the country and sometimes internationally. They include authors, lawyers, activists, scholars, and many more. That's Wednesday at 5 p.m. right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial, free, and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media. So Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
Are you interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Matthew Prescott, author of Food is the Solution. And we're talking about some of the discoveries he made in writing his book and researching his book, which is a combination cookbook and environmental book, talking about some of the negative impacts that meat and dairy production has on the planet. So, right before our break, Matthew, I was asking you about some of the stories whose lives have been disrupted by, animal production and the environment. Can you share some of those stories with us?
Yeah, you know, I was really moved to be able to talk to a lot of people across the country whose lives have been, like you said, disrupted by factory farming, by the meat industry. When we think about factory farming, you know, a lot of people think about the animals themselves confined in tiny cages or confined in tiny crates. What we often don't think about are the lives of humans that are impacted by these farms, by these mega farms. I met a woman in the course of writing the book named Lisa, who lives in a region called the Eastern Shore of Maryland on the Delmarva Peninsula. She and her husband, Joe, live on land that's been part of their family for like four generations. They've been there forever. Really nice community, really quaint community, except for one thing. These giant chicken farms are now invading. And Lisa and Joe, when I visited them, they were saying they're probably going to have to sell their house. They're going to have to sell this family property that's been in their family for generations because so many chicken factory farms are popping up in their neighborhood. I drove through there.
And they said they wouldn't be able to really sell it for much money now because of that problem, right? I mean,
that's right.
You know, this was part of their livelihood, and now the value of it is so low because of what's going on. But finish the story. Yeah, tell us what's going on there.
Absolutely, yeah. They're going to have to sell this family property and probably for a pittance. And, you know, when you drive through their neighborhood, it's really amazing. A totally normal neighborhood in most ways, like split-level homes. You got toys in the front yard, basketball hoops in the driveway, except after, like, every fourth or fifth house, there's a giant factory farm just right there in the neighborhood, right down these side streets. And so you've got these massive trucks rolling in and out all day long, carrying birds and supplies. You've got buzzards flying overhead constantly ready to pick off the dead birds along the side of the road. You've got an awful stench in the air. You've got flies in the air so thick you can't even go outside. And this is what they deal with day after day right in their backyard. I talked to, you know, people in upstate New York who are dealing with the impacts of a mega dairy farm nearby where they turn on their faucets sometimes and feces come out of their bathroom faucets. You know, there are people in Missouri who fought back against a pig factory farm that was going to be set up in their really historic, quaint community, and it was just going to completely ruin their economy. They had a very tourist-based economy, and this pig factory farm was just going to ruin it. And so there are people all over the country every day who are in real ways dealing with the environmental implications of these factory farms, unable to even go outside, unable to enjoy their neighborhoods, and it's just a really sad situation for so many people across the country.
Yeah. You know, I always wondered why, you know, they don't have certain regulations for processing, like even the waste from these animal factory farms. I mean, human waste goes through a waste processing plant, but somehow animal waste is allowed to just sit there and fester in these like big ponds and whatever. It's unbelievable. They don't even go through any type of treatment to try to mitigate the problem at all. They just allow it to accumulate.
Yeah, they sit in these big lagoons. You know, pig farms or cattle farms have these waste lagoons that sit kind of in the middle of their property. And in my book, I talk a lot about how in North Carolina, for example, in 1999 during Hurricane Floyd, those waste lagoons became so flooded that they just disseminated out into the rivers and into the waterways, just destroying life in all of those local waterways, all the way out into the Gulf of Mexico. And there's a photo in the book of an aerial shot of one of these factory farms with a waste lagoon in the middle, and it just looks otherworldly. And I really encourage anybody who's interested in seeing what it looks like to either pick up a copy of the book or just go online and Google it, and you won't believe your eyes.
Yeah, I've seen it. And you also have a lot of the infographs that you have are really powerful. I mean, you know, the one I'm looking at right now about the poultry problem, you know. Why do you think, like, in 1960, you say there was 34 pounds of chicken eaten per person, and now in 2016, 108 pounds of chicken eaten per person. That's a 215% increase. Why do you think that happened? Why? I mean, are people eating? They can't be eating that much more. What's changed?
Yeah, we're eating a lot more meat than we were in the past. But, you know, I think that to younger people today, I'm 36, to people in my generation or younger, it's just like totally normal and commonplace to eat huge amounts of meat at every single meal. But past generations didn't eat that much meat. Like you said, in 1960, the average person ate 200% less chicken than they eat today. Part of the reason for that is because factory farms have become so industrialized that meat has become so much cheaper. So we're just gorging ourselves on it. The average chicken today grows at a rate that would be like a two-month-old human baby weighing 600 pounds because chicken factory farmers have just kind of pushed their genetic limit to get more and more and more out of these birds to make them bigger and bigger and bigger at a younger age so that we can keep feeding this huge addiction to meat. And, you know, all these animals that we're producing now cause, you know, huge environmental problems, not just the type that I talked about with regard to Lisa and Joe and Maryland and so many other people. But, you know, you take chickens, for example. In the same region that Lisa lived in, Maryland, the Delmarva Peninsula, was really rife with chicken farms. And 1.5 billion pounds of poop produced from these chickens every year. It's a really incredible number. And what we do is a huge problem. How we, you know, you mentioned before how we treat it all. Well, it goes into waterways, it seeps into the land, and it's just a major, major epidemic.
Wow. You know, that's the kind of part, that's the part of meat that people don't think about. You know, I mean, people might hear, okay, meat's not so good for you, let's eat less. But when you actually think of the quantity that we are raising and, you know, how to handle all the waste from that. I mean, you know, again, when people were just hunters and gatherers, you know, the animals were living out in the wild. You know, the poop went into the soil and, you know, it wasn't a problem because it wasn't mass-produced in this same way. What we're
doing
now,
and even
so
beyond
unnatural.
Gatherers, like even you know, a generation or two ago, things weren't as bad. We have, in 1950, the total number of farm animals in the U.S., was about 100 million animals. Today it's 9 animals. That's a 9,500% increase in the number of animals we're dealing with just since 1950 and just in the U.S.
How many now? I'm sorry, how many did you say now?
About 9 billion with a B, from 100 million with an M to about 9 with a B just since 1950.
Wow. That's amazing.
And so, you know, this is these are all the reasons why so many people are gravitating more toward a plant-based diet. Again, whether, you know, doing vegan, you know, full-on or vegan wannabe like you are, or, you know, Meatless Mondays again, every little bit helps. And people are starting to get that if we are going to save the planet from environmental disaster, whether climate change or any other major environmental problems that are plaguing us right now, we've just got to simply switch to a different model. We can't be raising that many animals for food. It's completely unsustainable. Plant-based foods, on the other hand, are way more efficient to produce. They take less land, less water. They emit fewer greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And they're just much lighter on the planet. And so when we sit down to eat, we've got this choice. And we make it three times or more if we're lucky, if we have access to food. And so many people are making the better choice now. Again, whether they're doing it at every single meal or at some meals, people want more plant-based foods, and you can find it everywhere nowadays.
Mm-hmm. One thing you touch on in the book that I'm really glad you touch on is environmental racism. You know, you actually talk about how a lot of these facilities, these factory farms, are being placed in lower-income neighborhoods inhabited by people of color or immigrants, people that are not disenfranchised, that, you know, maybe don't have the power, the financial influence to fight back. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, that community on the eastern shore of Maryland that I talked about where Lisa lives, they're not wealthy people. It's not a wealthy neighborhood. It's a totally normal kind of middle class, lower middle class neighborhood. These people don't really have a voice. And that neighborhood is largely Caucasian, but so many neighborhoods where these factory farms set up across the country are inhabited by people of color or people of low income or both. And that's no accident. The reason for that is because those disenfranchised populations don't have as much of a voice in the political system or in the social system to be able to combat what's happening in their neighborhood. And so factory farmers take advantage of that, and they set up shop in these rural, poor, places of color. And it's just racism flat out. There's no other way to put it. And so experts actually call it environmental racism because it is almost a purposeful attempt to exploit the lack of power by those disenfranchised communities.
But isn't that where the farmers live too, or do they live somewhere else?
Well, you know, in our factory farming system, farmers are the individual farmers who run these facilities are, you know, almost kind of like indentured servants to major corporations. And, you know, it sounds, you know, kind of crazy, but that's the way it works. You know, the animal protein industry is really run by just a few companies. So, you know, I mentioned, for example, that we have 9 billion animals in the U.S. Animals, every kind, pigs, chickens, cows, turkeys, you name it. 2 billion of those animals are controlled by just one company, Tyson Foods. So, you know, that's about a fifth of all the animals in the country are under the control at some point of just one corporation. Now, Tyson Foods is a major chicken company. They contract out with all these farmers in all these communities to raise the chickens, but they ultimately control how it's done. And so I don't blame the farmers. Really, the farmers in these individual communities are victims as much as, you know, as much as the communities are themselves. They're just trying to make a living. I think the real kind of culprits here are the major factory farming conglomerates that own the production systems and that are responsible for kind of all the nefarious things that come along with it.
Interesting. And so, you know, I know we're right now the farm bill is being debated between the House and the Senate, and they're talking about subsidies and, you know, the subsidies that are in place now that are supposed to be help farmers are really just helping the corporations. You know, those subsidies don't go to the small farmers who are trying to do the right thing. They're going to the farmers that are raising these commodity crops to feed these animals. Can you talk a little bit about that? Are you familiar with
yeah,
that?
And you know, the craziest thing about it is the farming industry, especially the animal farming industry, always kind of decries added regulations, environmental regulations, animal welfare regulations. They always have this talking point that they know their business best and nobody else should tell them how to do their business. They don't want the government coming in and saying you can't confine animals in tiny cages. They don't want the government coming in and saying, you know, you have to, you know, use certain procedures to ensure clean water, clean air. They hate all that stuff. But they sure like to take subsidies and handouts from the government when it's convenient for them. The dairy industry is a great example. People are drinking way less dairy than they used to. In just the last few years, dairy sales in the U.S. have dropped by $1 billion because people are drinking more almond milk and soy milk and coconut milk and all kinds of other milks. And so the dairy industry is very happy to have the government buy up tons of its plus product. It's overproducing. It hasn't stopped production because less people are buying the product. It hasn't adhered to the law of supply and demand. It's still just producing dairy like it always was. It's just having the government buy it up and in some cases just score it. You know, it's these industries get massive aid from the government. They don't like the regulations, but they're sure happy to take a handout.
Right. Or they provide it to other countries that don't want it, but they force them to take it, or they threaten them with cutting back other benefits, you know? I mean,
yes, incredible.
You know, yeah. Oh, it's so complicated, isn't it? It's so complicated.
It is complicated, but, you know, at the same time, I do, you know, the good news is that it's a complicated issue, it's a complicated system, but it has a really simple solution. And that's the message.
Let's talk about some of those.
Well, yeah, that's why I titled the book Food is the Solution, because it really is the solution to so many of these complicated problems. If we can change the way we eat, and millions of people are, to focus more on these plant-based foods that are better for the planet, better for ourselves, don't support these really nefarious industries as much or at all, we can really solve a lot of these crises. And
yes,
you know,
people are drinking less of dairy, and yet they're not producing less dairy, how is that? And the government's just buying it up. How is that solving the problem?
Well, I think that they'll have to at some point. The dairy industry will reach a point where they've realized that they've just got to stop producing as much. And in fact, a lot of meat and dairy companies are starting to shift their production methods to account for this. You know, they're not quite there yet, but for example, Tyson Foods, that chicken company that I mentioned earlier, they're investing heavily in plant-based foods. They're investing now in a company called Beyond Meat that makes plant-based burgers and chicken and all kinds of other products like that. Dean Foods, which is the largest dairy company in the country, they previously bought and owned the brand Silk, soy milk and almond milk that is so ubiquitous in every grocery store. And so the more we eat plant-based foods, the more the industry does take notice and the more they will start to move in that direction. And, you know, I think that is one area where there's just a lot of opportunity for people to make an impact, is by showing these major food corporations that there's a market for this stuff out there, and they can make a lot of money by producing more plant-based items.
Right. But what we need to keep all of our audience aware of is that, you know, these big companies buy up these products that, you know, that we've become consumers of, and, you know, we have certain consumer loyalty. That's why, you know, so many companies try to market to young people, because they feel like, you know, once they get someone buying their product when they're young, they'll buy their product for life. But a product like you mentioned, silk, you know, silk, soy milk used to all be organic. Once Dean Foods bought it, they didn't advertise that they were no longer organic, but they stopped being organic. I think they still made an organic brand that was separate. But, you know, soybeans are one of the most genetically modified crops in this country. And so, you know, to drink soy milk from GMO unorganic soybeans is silly. It's not something anybody should be doing. So,
well, I think the power there is still with the consumer. You know, Dean Foods bought White Wave because they saw this huge market for soy milk, because dairy sales were declining and sales of soy milk and almond milk were skyrocketing. And so I think that, you know, if more people are, you know, start buying the organic soy milk, the organic almond milk, there too we'll see a shift. I think that is, you know, that's kind of capitalism at play in a good way, where, you know, a lot of the power really is with the consumer to show what we want in the marketplace.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why it's so important that people really know what's in our foods, because most people don't. I mean, it's amazing to me still how many people are buying, you know, chicken that's, you know, has hormones or antibiotics, or, you know, even if they say, you know, sometimes it's all in the marketing. I mean, they'll say no human antibiotics being used. Well, they're not using the human antibiotics, but they have all these antibiotics that we don't even know about that they use just for
animals. You know, the chicken industry loves to do a thing where they say hormone free, you know, no added hormones, hormone free. Well, it's against federal regulation to give chickens any hormones in the country, so all chicken is hormone free. It's not the hormones that are the problem. It's, like you said, the antibiotics. But the meat industry and the poultry industry like to do this little kind of wordplay where they, you know, they call the product something in a marketing fashion that it is anyway.
Right. Well, I laughed one time. I saw a sign by, next to broccoli, saying gluten free. You know, it's like they'll market anything. You know, all vegetables, they're all gluten free. You know, but they're, you know, they'll put, you know, a sign that will say, you know, low trans fat, you know, next to a broccoli, and, you know, doesn't have trans fat. You know, it's just
I saw a bottle of water the other day that said gluten-free on it.
Right, right. You know, so, you know, we all have to become savvy, really smart consumers, because, you know, they'll market anything to us to try to get us to buy in, even when it's, you know, it never was a problem to start with. Like you said, all chicken is hormone-free. But the antibiotics are not only – the antibiotics they use are not only used to keep disease down because they're housed in such horrible situations, but some of the antibiotics actually made them grow quicker, didn't it? Didn't they find that to be the case?
Yeah, there's you know, two types of antibiotics. There's a type of antibiotics that's intended to keep animals alive through conditions that are – so filthy they would otherwise die. And then there's growth-promoting antibiotics, you know, subtherapeutic antibiotics, and they're both a huge problem. The chicken industry especially uses these growth promoters in addition to kind of genetic manipulation of animals, where they select birds, you know, specifically for the trait of fast growth. And it creates a huge amount of problems. You know, these animals I mentioned earlier, for people who were listening earlier, grow at a rate that would be like a two-month-old child weighing 600 pounds. And,
right,
you know, their legs break out from under them. They have heart attacks when they're just babies. Their lungs fail. They can barely move. It's a really, really sad state of affairs for chickens in the U.S., which is, you know, part of the reason why a lot of people are now eating less of that stuff or none at all.
Mm-hmm. So we are almost out of time, but just quickly, can you share what was your greatest surprise, good or bad, when developing the recipes for this book?
Well, I think, you know, my greatest surprise, and it was a good surprise in producing the book, you know, I don't think it came with the recipes, but it came in terms of the amount of support that I received for it from all kinds of different folks. You know, there are, in the beginning of the book, quotes of support about it from people like Wolfgang Puck, your very meat-heavy chef. People like Jose Andreas, he has an essay in the book. He also, you know, uses a lot of meat in his cooking. Emeril Lagasse, the chef from New Orleans, who's, you know, known for his seafood and meat and other products like that, lent a quote of support to. And I think I was surprised, pleasantly so, to see so much support from these types of folks who, yeah, they use a lot of meat in their cooking, they use a lot of seafood in their cooking, a lot of dairy, but they all seem to recognize that the one thing that we can all agree upon is that we simply should be eating more plant-based foods. Whether we still eat meat or not, we can all agree that we ought to be eating more plant-based foods. And so that was a real pleasant surprise for me.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So why don't you just share it with everybody one last time, your book and how they can buy it. Is it available at bookstores or Amazon? What do you recommend?
Yeah, the book is Food is the Solution, What to Eat to Save the World. You can find it on Amazon. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble. You can buy it at Costco. You can buy it at Whole Foods, everywhere where books are sold, or just Google it and pick it up on Amazon. Food is the Solution.
Thank you. Matt, I love your book. Thank you so much. You know, I'm working on a cookbook that I've been working on for a while that has a lot of, you know, the same topics that you talk about, because it is, food is why, or I should say, the reason I am so passionate about food is because it connects all these things that are so important: our health, our environment, community, people. I mean, it's all connected, and you do just a beautiful job in this book bringing it all together and making it really accessible for everybody. So thank you so much for the book.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on today. This was fun.
Sure. And everyone listening, thanks for joining. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the day, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.